Ekhatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling a, really fascinating and frankly, quite sobering story, the rise and spectacular fall of General Electric.
Yeah, we're digging into the book Lights Out, Pride, Delusion, and the Fall of General Electric by Thomas Greta and Ted Mann.
And this isn't just some dusty corporate history, is it? We're talking about GE. I mean, the company basically founded by Thomas Edison, an absolute icon of American industry for, what, a century?
Exactly. For decades, it was the most valuable, most admired corporation in the world. And yet, between roughly 2000 and 2018, its value just plummeted. We're talking 90% loss. They almost went bankrupt.
Staggering. So the big question the book tackles and what we're exploring is how. How does a company like that, famed for its management, essentially self-destruct?
And that's really why it matters today. You know, it's this huge cautionary tale. It tells you a lot about some dangerous trends in modern business, especially this thing called financialization.
Right, where the focus shifts maybe too much from actually making things, you know, building turbines or jet engines, to just making the numbers look good for Wall Street, prioritizing the stock price over the actual business.
Precisely. Short-term gains over long-term health. And GE is, well, maybe the ultimate example of how badly that can go wrong.
Okay, so if the problems were internal, we need authors who really got inside. Tell us about Thomas Greta and Ted Mann.
Well, their credibility is top-notch. These guys are seasoned reporters for the Wall Street Journal. They weren't just commentators. They actually covered GE extensively for years.
So they were watching this unfold in real time.
Exactly. They had that front row seat. They were talking to people inside, seeing the documents, tracking the decisions as they happened. This isn't a retrospective defense by an ex-CEO or some consultant's theory.
It's journalism. Investigative journalism.
Right. Grounded in that journalistic objectivity. They were committed to figuring out what actually happened, the complex financial stuff, the cultural issues, the strategic blunders. They lived the story.
Okay, so let's get into the book itself. What's the core argument? The authors say it wasn't just bad luck or market forces.
No, not primarily. Their central thesis is pretty stark, actually. They argued GE's collapse wasn't caused by some external shock. It was a systematic dismantling from within.
Driven by what?
Decades of short-term thinking, really aggressive financial maneuvering, some might say manipulation, and ultimately a toxic internal culture that papered over the cracks.
So it's a story about culture change in a way. From Edison's innovation powerhouse.
Focused on engineering, building things.
Used something else entirely. A kind of bloated financial firm that happened to also own some industrial businesses.
Pretty much. A company obsessed, absolutely obsessed with hitting its quarterly earnings targets, its EPS number, no matter what.
And the book traces this chronologically.
Yeah, it follows the path. It shows how the seeds of the problems were really sown under Jack Welch, even during his celebrated tenure. Then, those problems got massively amplified under his successor, Jeff Immelt.
Until it all came crashing down.
Right. And it took John Flannery's brief time as CEO to really start exposing the mess, leading to the, well, the necessary but painful dismantling under the current CEO, Larry Culp.
So the book isn't just about GE then. It's using GE as a lens to look at broader issues.
Absolutely. It reads like an indictment of certain aspects of modern capitalism, this relentless focus on quarterly results, the cult of the celebrity CEO, and what happens when those things go unchecked.
It's a warning, really. Yeah. It can happen to GE.
It can happen anywhere. No company is immune if it falls into the same traps.
Okay, let's break down that timeline. You mentioned Jack Welch, often called manager of the century, the golden age, right? But with hidden flaws.
Yes, exactly. You have to acknowledge Welch's achievements. He absolutely transformed GE, streamlined it, made it incredibly valuable. That's undeniable.
But there's always a but, isn't there?
The but is big. The authors argue Welch's obsession, and it was an obsession with smooth, predictable, double-digit earnings growth every single quarter. Well, it created a fatal dependency.
On GE Capital, the finance division.
Yes. GE Capital became the engine that guaranteed those smooth earnings. When the industrial businesses, you know, the jet engines or power turbines, had a slow quarter,
GE Capital would step in and somehow make the numbers work.
Precisely. It became this opaque black box. They used complex accounting, lots of leverage, financial deals. Basically, whatever it took to hit that magic EPS number Welch demanded, it created this dangerous reliance on financial alchemy.
So the reported success wasn't always reflecting the sort of underlying health of the industrial core.
That's the argument. The success was real in terms of stock price and reputation, but it was increasingly propped up by finance, not just industry. And this had a cultural effect, too.
What kind of effect?
They call it success theater. The pressure to always deliver good news, to always meet the target, was immense. Managers learned very quickly that reporting bad news, or even potential problems, was career suicide.
So problems just got buried.
Buried, deferred, hidden. You create a culture where everyone pretends everything is great, even when they know it isn't. And those hidden problems, they fester.
Which leads us neatly into the next chapter. Jeff Immelt's inheritance. He takes over in 2001, right before 9/11, which must have been a huge shock.
A massive shock, especially for GE's aviation and insurance businesses. And Immelt did initially have this vision, remember, imagination at work. He talked about getting back to GE's industrial roots, eco-imagination.
So he saw the problem with relying too much on finance.
He probably did, intellectually. But the book argues he was trapped. He inherited Welch's legacy and, crucially, Welch's stock price. How could he dismantle GE Capital, admit the past success was partly built on financial engineering, without tanking the stock and destroying Welch's image?
So he couldn't unwind it. What did he do instead?
He tried to sort of double down, grow the industrial side so much that it would eventually overshadow the financial risks. But this led to some really disastrous bets.
Like the Alstom acquisition.
That's the big one. A massive, over $10 billion bet on power generation technology, buying the French company Alstom's energy assets.
And the timing was bad.
Catastrophically bad. He bought it right at the peak, just as the global market for those specific gas turbines was about to collapse because of the rise of renewables and cheaper natural gas. Just terrible timing and arguably a failure of due diligence.
The book portrays Immelt as very optimistic, right? Yeah. Maybe too optimistic.
Relentlessly optimistic. And the authors frame that optimism, maybe charitably, as eventually becoming a form of denial, a refusal to see just how deep the problems ran, both in the struggling power division and still lurking within GE Capital.
Okay, so the denial couldn't last forever. What triggered the great unraveling?
The 2008 global financial crisis. That was the moment the tide went out and everyone saw who'd been swimming naked, so to speak.
And GE Capital was exposed.
Brutally exposed. It wasn't just a finance arm. It was essentially a huge, unregulated bank deeply entangled in the global credit markets. When those markets froze, GE Capital couldn't fund itself. The illusion of GE, the stable industrial giant, just shattered overnight.
I remember the bailout. Warren Buffett.
Yeah, humiliating for GE. They had to take emergency funding from Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway and, crucially, backing from the U.S. government, just like the big banks. It revealed how reliant they were on that financial black box.
But 2008 wasn't even the end of the bad news, was it?
Not even close. After the immediate crisis, other time bombs started to surface. The biggest one was probably in their legacy insurance business, specifically long-term care insurance.
Stuff they'd sold decades ago.
Exactly. Policies sold maybe in the 80s or 90s based on assumptions about healthcare costs and life expectancy that turned out to be wildly wrong.
Because people lived longer and care got way more expensive.
Massively more expensive. So GE found itself facing billions upon billions of dollars in liabilities it hadn't properly reserved for. It was this huge hidden hole in the balance sheet that had been ignored or downplayed for years.
It sounds like a perfect storm.
It was, because fundamentally the cash flow from the actual industrial businesses, the engines, the turbines, the medical scanners, it just wasn't strong enough anymore to cover everything. It couldn't cover the dividends stockholders expected, the massive pension obligations GE had, and these exploding insurance liabilities and other GE Capital problems. The core wasn't generating enough real cash.
Which leads to the final act. The desperate measures. John Flannery comes in as CEO.
Right. In 2017, he only lasted about 14 months, but his tenure was significant because he was the first insider CEO willing to do the painful deep dive and admit publicly just how bad things were.
You cut the dividend, right? That was symbolic.
Hugely symbolic. Cut it in half. For a company like GE, whose reliable dividend was sacrosanct for generations of investors, that was a massive admission of failure.
But even that wasn't enough. The bad news kept coming.
It did. The real shocker under Flannery was the massive $22 billion goodwill write-down in the power division.
Okay, explain goodwill write-down in plain English.
Basically, goodwill is the premium a company pays when it buys another company above the value of its actual assets. Writing it down means admitting you overpaid massively. So that $22 billion write-down was GE saying, "Oops, that Alstom business and other power assets we bought, they're worth $22 billion less than we thought."
Wow, that's admitting a huge mistake.
A colossal mistake. It obliterated whatever credibility management had left. Flannery was quickly ousted by the board.
And they brought in Larry Culp, the first outsider CEO ever at GE.
Yes, Culp was known as a turnaround specialist. He wasn't hired to preserve the empire. He was hired as a corporate surgeon to basically save the patient by dismantling the conglomerate. Selling off prize assets like the biopharma unit, slashing the dividend down to a mere penny.
Just stopping the bleeding.
Exactly. Painful, drastic surgery to stabilize the company's finances and try to chart a path forward for the core pieces that remained.
Okay, let's step back from the timeline.
Yeah.
What are the big themes, the key messages the authors want us to take away from this whole saga?
Well, theme number one, and maybe the biggest, is this dangerous shift from operational excellence to financial engineering. You know, the move away from building great products and running businesses efficiently towards just manipulating financial results.
Making the numbers look good versus actually being good.
Precisely. And it makes you reflect, right? In our own work or companies, what metrics are we really chasing? Substance or just appearance?
That focus on appearance ties into another theme, doesn't it? The cult of the celebrity CEO.
Absolutely. Jack Welch became this larger-than-life figure, Neutron Jack, manager of the century. That legendary status created a sort of halo effect.
Meaning people didn't question him or his successor, Immelt, enough.
Exactly. The board, the media, investors, the admiration kind of morphed into unquestioning acceptance. It raises the question, when does respecting leadership become dangerous deference?
And the board itself is another theme, the failure of corporate governance.
Yeah, GE had this incredibly prestigious board full of famous names, but the book argues they were largely passive. They acted more like cheerleaders for management than skeptical watchdogs doing their duty.
They weren't asking the tough questions about GE Capital or the Alstom deal.
Apparently not forcefully enough, which highlights the need for a truly independent skepticism in the boardroom. Who's asking the uncomfortable questions?
And all this was enabled by the culture, the cancer of success theater you mentioned earlier.
It all ties together. If your culture punishes anyone who brings bad news, then of course the board isn't going to hear the full truth. Problems like the insurance shortfall or the cracks in the power division, they just fester under the surface for years, decades even, until they become catastrophic.
It really makes you think about how critical transparency is, even when the truth is unpleasant.
Essential. How can you fix problems if you pretend they don't exist?
The book seems to have some really sharp lines that capture these ideas.
It does. The authors have a knack for summing up complex issues concisely.
Like the one. GE became a company that managed earnings rather than managing the business.
Yeah, that perfectly captures the shift in focus. It wasn't about long-term industrial health. It was about hitting the next quarter's number for Wall Street.
Or they had confused financial engineering with actual engineering.
Right. Treating spreadsheets and clever accounting almost like it was the same as inventing a better jet engine, giving financial maneuvering the same prestige as real innovation.
And this one highlights the danger of complexity. GE's complexity had become a feature, not a bug away to obscure problems rather than solve them.
That's a powerful one. The sheer size and opacity, especially of GE Capital, wasn't just an accident. It became a tool to hide weaknesses, to make it almost impossible for outsiders to truly understand the risks.
And finally, the cultural addiction. The company had become addicted to making its numbers, quarter after quarter, using whatever means necessary.
That sums up the relentless pressure cooker environment. That addiction demanded riskier and riskier behavior just to keep feeding the beast. Unsustainable at the end of the day.
So thinking practically, what are the real-life applications here? What should people take away from GE's story?
Well, for investors or analysts, it's a huge lesson in skepticism. Don't just look at the headline earnings per share, the EPS number. You have to dig deeper into the real cash flow.
Where's the actual money coming from?
Exactly. And be incredibly wary of companies that rely heavily on complex, opaque divisions, those black boxes like GE Capital, to deliver smooth, predictable earnings. If you can't understand how they're making money, that's a red flag.
What about for people actually running companies, managers and leaders?
I think the key is intellectual honesty. Leaders have to be willing to confront the brutal facts about their business, even when they're unpleasant. And crucially, build a culture that rewards finding and fixing problems, rewards transparency, not just hitting short-term targets through, you know, financial gimmicks.
And for board members.
It's a massive call to action. This story shows what happens when boards fail to provide real oversight. They must ask the tough questions, demand clear answers, especially about complex areas, and not just get charmed or intimidated by a celebrity CEO. They need to be watchdogs, not lapdogs.
Reflecting on all this, what stands out most to you? What's the biggest surprise or takeaway?
For me, what's really striking is how the seeds of the disaster were planted during the celebrated Welch era. It wasn't that Immelt messed up a perfect company. It's that the very things Welch was praised for, the relentless earnings focus, the creation of the GE Capital powerhouse, contained the ticking time bomb. The fall was almost baked in.
Yeah, that's sobering. For me, I think the enduring lesson is just that simple, stark reminder. No company is too big or too prestigious to fail. Greatness isn't permanent. It has to be constantly earned through discipline, humility, and a connection to reality.
And we should also remember the human cost. When a giant like GE stumbles, it's not just shareholders who get hurt. It impacts tens of thousands of employees, retirees relying on pensions, entire communities built around GE plants. The ripple effects are enormous.
A truly cautionary tale with wide-ranging consequences. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.